You can start recording.
Okay.
All right, good morning, everyone. It is 10:34 a.m. on Thursday, August 13th, 2020. And then, would that be Conrad on the feedback?
Conrad, we're getting some feedback from you.
Yeah, can you mute Conrad? Okay, perfect. So this is a legislative discussion. It's a work session. I don't have any opening comments. Commissioner Fedorchak?
I don't have any opening comments other than I read through them and thought that there's some interesting proposals in here. Not as much craziness as I expected from our staff. So thanks for that. And otherwise, look forward to our discussion.
Perfect. Commissioner Crisman?
I think just for viewers that are listeners, people that are here, this is generally a list that's been put together by staff of things that have come up, not necessarily even strong proposals, but just kind of an initial discussion point to see what we're interested in, as opposed to things that we have. These aren't a list of things that we've come up with as proposals. It's various things from the last year and a half that staff has run into to see if we're interested.
Perfect. And I had a conversation with Jack prior to the meeting, the work session, and Commissioner Crisman alluded to this. There are quite a number of potential changes or avenues, roads to go down. So I asked, you know, our discussion was, well, what do you want out of this? And of course, obviously, some direction on whether or not we're interested in pursuing some of these things, whether it's all of them or some of them, but knowing where to focus your time and energy. So I think a screening process of sorts and direction for staff to move forward or potentially discontinue the conversation on a particular change. So with that, Jack, I thought I would turn it over to you as we discussed, and then you can just start at the beginning, I suppose, and work our way through.
That sounds good. And I, just to give a little background, I did meet with all the directors, and Brian and I sat down and discussed these as well. And they provided me a list of different things they may be interested in having changed in the legislative session. If it was just a minor alteration in an obscure area, we tended not to bring it up if we didn't feel it would have some sort of impact at all. To the extent that we were already going to propose something in a different area, like, say, the Siting Act, then we were more interested in cleaning some other things up as well while we were in there, even some of the minor things. I guess I would be, if any of the directors want to hop in on any of these items, I'm just going to start running through them. I know you guys have a little more background on them, and maybe feel free to provide a little more explanation if you feel that is needed on these items as well.
Do you think we should go around, and I didn't bring this up, but do introductions really quick just so it's a part of the record?
Sure, if you'd like to. I'm John Hsu, legal counsel.
Dean Mose, Director of Reclamation and AML Divisions.
Jill Kringstead, Accounting.
Brian Johnson, Legal.
John Hamry, Administrative Staff.
Patrick Fun, Director of Public Utilities Division.
And then we also have Conrad Crawford on remotely.
And Steve Call, Executive Secretary.
Okay. Could have made
and
this.
Shelley Bosky, Compliance Division.
Okay, perfect. See, I could have made this really interesting and then asked everyone to give a sentence or two on what you'd like to get out of this. But then I felt like a consultative of sorts, so we won't do that.
It's going to be a long meeting.
Matt, can you tell us how many others are online listening?
It is just
Shelley
and Conrad.
Oh,
it's just internal.
Oh, we aren't broadcasting?
There's no case number attached to it, so we
don't. No broadcast, no public.
Oh, okay.
Well, just to open up, we have the Reclamation Division. Dean provided me a number of changes. And if you recall, during the last couple informals and formal hearings, the time frames are very tight.
Just one second on the broadcast issue. Is there an expectation right now from folks outside that we are broadcasting everything? I'm just thinking of others that often show up, like Carly McLeod and, you know, some of those people who typically watch this sort of stuff and aren't here. I hate for that. Is there any downside to broadcasting?
If you guys feel like we...
I don't know what levels you would cut it off at, but we don't typically, haven't in the past, broadcast every budget discussion or employee issues. Or
this is far from a typical year.
It is, but it's I mean, well, but even those, do you broadcast them? This is a work session. It's not like we're making proposals here.
I guess I'm just wondering if there's a downside to doing it.
I don't think so. How difficult would it be for someone to get the recording after the fact?
It's all posted. The recording is after. On our website.
All right. Well, so. I'm fine with that. Then they can listen to the recording.
Yeah. Although I think in the future for a conversation like this, if we had teed it up, and if people wanted to tune in from remotely, that would have been fine too.
True.
I do kind of think people are expecting our stuff to be broadcast just because most everything has been. And wouldn't necessarily know, there's no case number for this. That's why they wouldn't.
Well, it's easy enough for us to start it.
I guess it's the same thing. If we broadcast or don't, or have it available on the recording, it's just that if they're trying to right now and are frustrated, why can't they get it?
Sure.
I guess I would vote in favor of broadcasting it now, just to make it available.
Is there a dial-in number? Would anyone even know that we're live?
Most of them would just check our website. They do that regularly, so yeah.
I mean, it doesn't hurt to go live just in case, but I don't know if someone knows how to gain access at this point.
The vast majority of people, I think, at this
I think the vast majority of people at this point do know how to get to our website. And
it doesn't hurt, correct? Okay.
That's no problem doing that.
All right.
I think it's a good suggestion.
No broadcast on public bridge.
I don't know if you need the public bridge for broadcast.
Okay, turn it on.
There we are.
All right, so just to get back into it, for formal and informal conference procedures and hearing procedures, if you remember, we were kind of operating on a very tight timeline, and that's partially due to the scheduling as well as the ability for the commission to actually get together in the same room and all the parties as well. And so Dean provided a number of changes, and for the most part, it just extends the time frame of which we need to hold a hearing from 30 to 45 days, essentially giving us another 2 weeks. In which to hold the hearing. And also it requires that they have to request a permit renewal within some additional time. They have to do it from, instead of 120 days before the expiration. Dean's kind of floating the idea past OSM right now of 150 or 180 days. And it's worth noting that any of these changes, it has to go by OSM regardless for any sort of statutory or rulemaking change. And we're still in the preliminary stages of actually reaching out to them and getting some input from them as well.
I think that the extra 2 weeks on the hearings is certainly good, assuming we can get OSM approval. The moving up the timeline for getting renewals filed, especially when you go to 2 months possibly, I think before we completely spend all of our time first waiting to find out on OSM, I'd be curious from the mine's perspective what that's going to involve and whether there's going to be a strong adverse reaction from mining companies to that and whether there's a good reason why they would have difficulty with that. So I think we need to work with them, and we've had great working relationships for years, and I think it's important to find out how this would impact them.
I think they'd be supportive of it. Now we send it out, saying that they have to submit we do a pre-renewal review where we identify things that they have to update with the renewal, and we say that it has to be filed at least 120 days, but we encourage early submittal, and for the most part they've been getting them in a month or two ahead of time. It's just with things lagging, if one party drops the ball for a week or two, it puts us in some pretty tight time frames. We had that with the Coyote Creek. Not only was the We were up against the deadline for the approval, but we had the hearing and trying to squeeze that in. And it seems that it's fine as long as you don't have a request for a hearing. But if you get a request for a hearing in there, it pushes everything. Those timelines are awful tight.
I just think it's important that we know from them, because
right.
there might be some reason why it doesn't work for them that
right.
I certainly would have no ability right. to be aware of. And
certainly, flow by them, I've made most of them aware that we're considering this, and I haven't heard anything, formally that they would be opposed to it. But we can certainly, alert them to it as well.
Just to qualify this as well, these are placeholders for discussion. The next step after this is then we reach out to the various stakeholders that are going to be impacted, and before we come back and draft something for an additional review from you and additional discussion. This is just to see whether this is something we even want to entertain at all together.
Jack, from my perspective, and Dean, I think it's good and it's appropriate since we did have that issue with this latest case, and I just wonder if there aren't some other timelines that cause that too, like the request for the hearing timelines that need to be examined too, because I felt like there was some waiting to the very last minute for those, which additionally added some pressure to us with the timeline.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I don't see that being a problem, because we have a four-week publication schedule, which the notice is put out for 4 weeks, once a week for 4 weeks, and it's 30 days after the close. That's really 60 days that they have to request, and I don't see that would be a problem. But we'll certainly take a look at it.
When they wait to the last day for requesting the hearing, that doesn't cause us...
In the Coyote Creek instance, it pushed us right well past the limit. We
right.
we had a.
I think that those extra 2 weeks was to accommodate that.
And then we have some notice requirements when there is either an informal or a formal, some notice requirements in there too. And it's almost impossible to meet.
Right. So I'd say look at the whole thing and make sure that we get the changes that are needed.
Okay. Next up, we have 49.02.01.3, and this would be a new section, and again, this is a placeholder. This isn't the final drafted language. This is just to see if this is even something there would be an interest in. Conrad brought up that maybe we'd like to propose a new section, putting a real program in law as opposed to keeping off on the side in the budget section. So I don't know if Conrad has any comments regarding that. There are a number of things that we would probably need to do, and maybe promulgate some rules or policies regarding credentials and how certain aspects of the program would move forward. But Conrad, I know you had some thoughts on that. Would you be interested in piping in on that?
Certainly. So this came about after taking a look at the pipeline safety program and reviewing the statutes that we have assigned to that program. And that we do have that program codified in the powers of the commission generally. And so it occurred to me that at least opening up the discussion to see what thought about adding a section that deals specifically with the rail safety program. Now, the programs operate functionally differently, in fact, the rail safety program, the violations and the fines versus the pipeline safety program, where the commission takes care of those. But I didn't know if we thought it would be necessary, Jack, and I thought it would be a good topic to bring up for discussion to kind of more cement that program into the statute. Or if this isn't maybe something that we want to do, but maybe the next session once we pass the additional pilot.
I think it's an interesting conversation. And after seeing this, was the first time I actually kind of started thinking about this concept. We have the broad jurisdiction to pursue rail safety, which is where we're operating under anyway, with the existing program. And my first inclination is to say that's where we should just hold. And I mean, just philosophically, I tend to hesitate to put programs into statute, because then it's harder to change them if conditions change, et cetera. Then you've got to go back and change the law,
sure.
Which is an extra step. And, you know, I'm not sure it's needed. I'm trying to think of other programs that we run. I mean, gas safety is certainly one. But are all of our programs in law?
My understanding is they all are. There's one unique aspect from this one as opposed to gas safety, as here we're actually just participating in a federal program, as opposed to, even though there's the federal program, we're actually we set our own regulations and that we're actually enforcing, yeah, on our local level. So and if Conrad feels the need to describe this a little more, we're really not doing any enforcing. We're just doing inspecting on this.
Well, we're supplementing the feds on this, and in gas safety, we're doing it for them.
That's correct.
So it is different in that respect. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Isn't the big issue whether it's going to be permanent or not?
Right.
As opposed, I think the smaller issue is whether it's how much we put into the century code on it.
Yeah.
And I'm certainly supportive of efforts to make it permanent.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that it's an issue where our chances of success are probably going to be determined before the legislative session. I think this is one where we need to find legislative sponsors for it rather than it being an agency bill.
Oh, for sure. If we pursued this.
If we pursue permanence to the program.
You mean permanence by putting it into Century Code, or permanence just in the budget? Or,
however, is it? Did we get a 4-year extension or a 2-year extension? It's just the 2-year, right? That we're not always operating one biennium at a time. That we get rid of that.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless whether it's by putting it in code or I don't know what all options there are, mm-hmm, to make it not something that is set to expire.
Right.
But I think that in order to cross that threshold, we need legislative sponsors to take heart in
for
it,
sure,
as opposed,
yeah,
to an agency bill.
I think, yeah, from a tax standpoint, if I were a legislator, I might look at it as an assumptive sell on, mm-hmm, our part, and that might push them in the wrong direction if they think that they're not driving the bus.
And from that standpoint, like I said, if these are just simple proposals being floated, we certainly don't have to take this up at all. So I'm.
But I guess I just don't have strong feelings about how to achieve that. But I think we should be doing something to try to keep that program stable and,
right,
not always have those employees subjected to this question, mm-hmm, of whether it's going to be renewed or not. Not that everything isn't always up in the air every time the legislature,
right,
meets, but that seems like it's more questionable than most other things around here.
Well, I'm glad you guys put this together, because it might be a tool to use in the I wouldn't present it as an agency budget, but it could be a tool to use in discussions with legislators about the permanence and say, you know, if we get strong support on making it permanent, which we've had in the past, and I think maybe we'll have more of that this time, then we could float, like, well, you know, if you really want to,
sure,
put this issue to bed, you could try this as well.
Sure. So we could just hold on to this, and this would be a if-then type,
yeah,
one? Okay. All right, then moving on to 490208, and this is for testing meters, and Pat probably could flesh this out a little more as well. Right now it states that we shall be making these tests. My understanding, Pat, is that we currently aren't sending people out to do these tests ourselves. We rely heavily on the utilities to provide a number of tests and report back to us. And so this would still allow us the discretion to go out and do the tests ourselves if or hire a consultant to do so. In the meantime, we would continue our regulatory oversight the way we've been doing it as well.
The commission's rules require the, you know, public utilities to test the meters. This was a requirement on the commission, and it was a hard requirement. We shall make tests, and we just aren't doing that.
I guess when I read this, I assumed that we were following this by requiring the utilities to do it and send us their reports. Is that not how we're living up to this requirement currently?
I think that's how we would argue that we were doing it. Yeah. But I think that there might be a little bit of confusion, so that was something that Pat floated as something that would be clear that, well, this is really, we are gathering this data through our administrative rules, but we still could send out someone specifically to double-check and verify that data as well if we needed to.
What?
And that is something that we had done in the past, is go, like if we had a customer complaint about mm-hmm. that the meter was wrong, we used to have equipment to test meters, mm-hmm. and so we would go out. But we don't have that equipment, and we aren't going out.
So the wording would have to be the commission, whether it's the word shall or may, require utilities under our jurisdiction, make tests from time to time of meters of public utilities used, et cetera, et cetera. Something to that.
Well, that's the way our administrative rules are written. So we could do that if we really just wanted to wash our hands of the whole thing. But if we wanted to make it permissive, saying that we may still go out there and do it ourselves, we would probably just change it from shall to may.
That's not realistic if we don't have the equipment or the means to go test these units.
Not anyway. At the current time, it isn't. Right. But
we could have a third party do it, though.
Yes.
We also do hire consultants from time to time for smaller items.
I sort of like it the way it is, just because it makes it clear that there's going to be testing of these meters. And then our rules say how we're making that happen. I guess I don't worry that this requires us to go do the testing ourselves.
Pat, was the rule, is that implementation of this statute, or is that a reporting statute or administrative rule that we put in place?
Well, I know there are references to the law that's implemented in our rules, and I don't remember for sure on this one.
Maybe that's the thing to check.
Sure.
To see if that's what we did to implement this law, if it's tied.
Yeah, it'd be worth looking at. I guess the one thing is, if there is a customer who believes that they're being unfairly, the metering is incorrect, and the company providing these reports was incorrect, they could point to this and say, well, it says you're going to go do these yourselves and do these meter testing and from the shell.
And then we would say, we are. Well, we have implemented this. That's how we've done it. We can come out and do it, but we get the reports every year. And I mean, I know we get those and look at them. I don't know. I think saying may makes it, on the other hand, somebody looking at it like, oh, now they're not even going to check the meters anymore. So nobody knows whether it's right and whether we're being charged correctly, because they don't have to. They don't have to oversee it.
If I think that if they think that when it says may, then they're going to think that we're violating the law when it says that we shall, and we don't have even equipment, so we obviously technically do not do it ourselves. We have it done by someone else.
Maybe we're focusing on the wrong word, the shall and the may.
I thought it was a good draft. But
yeah, I guess my concern is the fact that this is the commission shall do these, and this is our duty to actually make these tests. And there might be misconstrued. And I want to say misconstrued, that seems like the most direct way you would construe that statutory section.
Seems like a more consistent way to match up with the rules. I'd have to look at the rules again, though.
Sure.
The commission shall make tests or require utilities make tests from time to time. Well, and if we put that in, then it's consistent, it sounds like, with the rules, and we're covered whether we do the tests mm-hmm. or they, but
yeah,
I think if the public were to see may, I would question, well, who's really
like
watching these?
Right. And so if that's the way we want to draft that, we can absolutely do it that way. I mean, if we're worried about how the public is going to perceive this, again, these are placeholders, so if this is something we're interested in changing, we could do that and kind of move portions of our rule in here as well to show that the public utility will report these things to us, and we'll be testing these things, and we may test in addition mm-hmm. to that as well.
I like Brian's suggestion.
Okay. Okay, so that moves us to 490302, the prerequisites for the issuance of a CPCN. And again, Pat, if feel free to hop in, but under the CPCN statute for gas, there are a number of factors that we look at prior to granting the certificate of need to extend facilities. There is nothing in our statute for electric, and so Pat thought there may be some clarification by adding some factors that we would be looking at would be useful. I was kind of trying to look back, peek back a little bit in the legislative history of this to kind of see the difference, and it wasn't abundantly clear. However, to a degree, I'm not sure if they're necessarily similarly situated. Rural, someone's either going to get served by the utility or their co-op, one of the two. And this mostly was an offshoot of the Territorial Integrity Act that was passed back in, I think, the 70s. But I'll turn this over to Pat, and he can tell you how he feels that maybe they'd be used to adding these factors in.
I just noted that there were no factors like there were under the other CPCN section.
Sure.
And just that it would be appropriate to have factors sure. here. We have to list issues in our notices. Mm-hmm. We have a notice for these proceedings, and we don't have a list to go by.
So how are we currently noticing for the electric CPCNs?
We are using these.
Oh, we are using the factors anyways?
We still use them.
Oh, okay. I suppose.
So they are listed in one part but not in another part?
Or? Yeah, if you look at the next one is 49.03.1, and this isn't in here, but that's the natural gas. But these exact factors are placed in the natural gas CPCN law.
And where did these come from? Was this did the natural gas ones, why were they added, or when were they added in there?
When were they added? I don't know.
They were probably put in there back in the origination of this law in 1975. Probably. Somewhere along the line, I think 1977, they separated off the law and changed the factors, and somewhere I think in that, more than likely in 1977, they separated the Territorial Integrity Act for electrical, moved the CPCN law for the natural gas, and didn't move the factors over with them, or didn't leave the factors with the electric side as well.
And then did these come from a court ruling, these factors?
These are in the statute. The ones for how we judge, we decide between a co-op and utility
right.
in the rural area, those are set in by the court. But these are actually set in statute for the gas, but not for the electric.
Okay, and the gas ones didn't get added because of a court. Like the court didn't
right.
say these, and then they didn't.
They were
did there
not.
Before.
Right.
So was this just an oversight? How have we acted without these for all these years?
We just acted as if they were there. And from what it sounds like, we're noticing these factors and considering these. But again, that's in the case that there's no dispute from that
question.
That extension into rural area.
By adding the factors, does it limit what we can look at from what we currently have by adding those factors in and limiting just to those?
Well, first off, this is what we are looking at. And so I don't, from what it sounds like Pat described, the limitation, I don't see any express limitation to these factors, similar to the court ruling that found that we look at these factors into determining who can serve this area for the Territorial Integrity Act. The one of the main questions I remember from the last couple of Supreme Court appeals was, are these exclusive? Because we kind of added a couple more in mm-hmm. there as well. And the court found that not expressly in their opinion, but of course they agreed with us, which would tell me that they're pretty comfortable within reason that we take into things that are for the public interest into consideration.
Well, when I contrast this to the last potential bill that we discussed where the law is requiring us to do something, and we believe that by doing a certain thing that that rises up to that level, but someone could potentially argue it. Here, we've got a situation where I don't know that anyone's objected to these, or the outside of we just found something that we're doing that's not in the law,
mm-hmm.
and now we would look to add it. I just don't think it's important enough to rise to the level of putting in a bill to add something that we've been doing a long time and hasn't caused any problem. You know, who knows what this becomes by the time mm-hmm. it's done if we throw this bill in for not that pressing of a reason, in my opinion.
I have the same concern.
And quite honestly, this is probably a very small. The only time that probably we would be in a situation where this would be a concern is if we had a new upstart electric utility. Say I started an electric utility myself and I started wanting to provide service to customers where we might want to look at and say, can you actually do this to these people? For the most part, our utilities that are extending their service are, of course, well-established and would meet these factors in of itself. So it probably hasn't been a big concern.
Yeah, and if you open this up and start having this, some people might be like, what in the world is going on? Who knows? Who knows what could happen? I would skip it.
Well, I agree with that from a practical standpoint, but I would be curious to see what would happen.
Do we need a distraction? Look at this shiny thing over here.
Heaven forbid. All right, so I'm going
to be assigned to that bill.
All right, the guidance I have is to not pursue that one.
Right.
So. Or let.
I did take basic electricity in high school, so
I almost feel like we have to shut this down and issue a notice of opportunity for hearing or something at that point.
All right, moving on to chapter, 40. I have 4905 here, but I'm not sure if that's in the right section. Oh, 4905.04.3, and I know there was a number of discussions or actually over the last few years that the commission has had over integrated resource plans and whether there would be interest in starting to do them with ADPs. I know there's a common concern that the commissioners I have expressed to me is I think we need a broader, more holistic view to really even be able to look at these items. And so integrated resource plan would be the place that probably we would do that holistic review. And so with this placeholder, I was just trying to beg the question of whether this is something we want to pursue. I know we have in the rules that they have to file an integrated resource plan with us, and this would provide a funding source as well, similar to a rate case. We're saying, well, if we're going to review this, we may request the funding in order to do an mm-hmm. investigation of these and pursuing it to that end.
Does this move it one step closer, though, to ruling or approving or not approving of a plan that a utility submits?
I would say it moves it closer to active engagement in some sort of recommendation or approval or absolute denial of a plan.
Leaves it open, though.
It does leave it open for how interactive.
It just makes it possible so that we could mm-hmm. actually charge a fee to do a serious review and provide scrutiny over the integrated resource plan. Currently, we get them. We don't have any money to hire assistance in reviewing them. They're very complicated applications, and so we don't do very much.
And I know our staff, to the extent that we can, we do review these, and we're looking into them, but at the very least, it's going to be a lot slower with one or two people looking into it as opposed to having some additional resources and maybe some engineering staff or consultants to help out with it as well.
How far does that would be? Take us, because the one thing that I've noticed, consultants are insanely expensive. And I'm amazed that they can say, okay, it's going to be $100,000 to $120,000 in their quote fees to review a particular case. this in a lot of ways seems as, if not more complicated than a rate case. Or would that not be
different
observation?
Different issues.
Right.
Potentially.
But how far would the filing fee take them? Do you think we would get a quality review?
Can we find a consultant that could do this?
I would hope so, but...
I would hope so, too. I think we could. But it would be potentially expensive.
Do you think $175, it was a placeholder I put in there, would be enough? Because I...
Well, I guess we haven't, we haven't reached out to try to find anybody to do these yet. And so I'm suspecting it'll be at least as high as a rate case.
Nature abhors a vacuum. Whatever that amount is what it's probably going to cost.
Yeah.
Because they'll know what
it right.
is.
Yeah.
If we're going to do much with those, other than, very loose review that we're able to do currently, we need the money. And we got to figure out what that amount is. And I think, if that is... best for a public information exchange or something like that, but
I think there's a strong likelihood that if the utility companies show up at the legislature saying this is just a terrible drain of hundreds of thousands of dollars, this isn't going to pass.
I think utilities would want to know, though, if we were going to take it to this the next level, that give us a ruling.
That probably will be their expectation, that they'll want that clarified. I don't know for sure, but I do think if they're going to fight it hard, I don't know if it's a hill that's worth dying on.
Well, I think we need to talk to the utilities before the session, just to get a read and to kind of have some a better understanding of what we're thinking. I like it because I think we've struggled with having the current process, which is case by case reviews of the ADPs, but this ADP is kind of driving the retirement of that resource. But yeah. That the whole conversation never happens. We don't have the full review, which happens in integrated resource planning. So I think that we're sort of hamstrung by having our imprint on what kind of resource mix we think should provide the kind of reliability we want long term for our North Dakota customers. So I think, in order to have that, we need to look at the integrated resource plans. And then secondly, in MISO in particular, and I'm sure SPP is similar, they develop these futures, which provides the basis for which all new projects are reviewed, and helps set the parameters for cost allocation, who is a beneficiary and who isn't, all these sorts of things, really important things. And those futures are based on state policy and IRPs. That's what they base the futures on, which have a huge impact on the overall policy at the RTO. So currently we don't have any state requirements for renewable resources that are driving that, or that they've already been met, and our IRPs aren't, there's nothing they can get from North Dakota on IRPs. So we basically are not providing any input into what future we think is appropriate or likely to happen. And I know we're a small player in the market, but we have three utilities, and that's a lot more than some states have too. So I'd like to see us start going down this path. It's scary. It's a big endeavor, and we have a small staff. So yeah, it's complicated and kind of scary, but Jack, I really like the approach you took on this, you and Pat.
And I will note, too, as well, that just because we have this, I wrote it saying at our request, so there may be three integrated resource plans we're looking. There's nothing that really kind of sticks out to us that's right. Really flagging any sort of concern, and we wouldn't need to really do any sort of review as well. However, maybe in a certain circumstance, there's one utility that's that just seems to be doing a minor departure of or a major departure from how they've previously been operating. We want to do a broader look at it too.
Are we familiar with some states that does at least believe to themselves that they thoroughly review IRPs and give approvals or disapprovals that contract out for advisory opinions on that?
That's something that I probably can't really speak to, but if you take a look at some of our consultants in the past with the with our ADPs, they've been kind of doing that to a minor degree. If you see, they say, well, we want to give you some sort of advice on this, but because of this, we're going to have to step back further and do some review of this, of the integrated resource plan as well, which they'll do. But, I mean, it is one more step back, but I'm sure there are consulting groups that can help us with the modeling and looking through and taking that apart.
I think it would be important to do some research, maybe through NARUC or something, find if there are states that do this through third party.
I'll make some
Who's doing that, and what kind of fees are associated with that, and then how thorough do they get for that kind of fee?
I can check with other states. I'd be more than happy, because I think I like it too. I just think we have to, I think the utilities, the logical question they're going to have is, or will be, okay, then what are you going to do with it? We're going to, you know, pay the fee. This type of money is going to be applied to having the IRP reviewed. And I think it's fair that they would want some type of a decision that we think you're on the right track or think you're on the right track, you know, with concerns in these areas, whatever it might be in terms. But they're looking for direction. You look at what Otter Tail has, what, about 40% of their customer base is in North Dakota? About right, Pat? MDU, much...
I thought it was about 50-50.
Yeah, it's more.
Yes. But, I mean, between MDU and Otter Tail, they have a significant percentage of their customer base right here in North Dakota. Yeah. XL, a little less. Well, significantly less, 6%. So.
Sure.
Okay. I think it's headed in the right direction.
The other thing that I think as we plan this, though, that just while we're together and discussing it, we got to kind of, I think, about what happens if we catch this bus. So what happens, what are we going to do about it if a company's IRP is something that we strongly object to and we're 6% of their customer base?
Sure.
Not necessarily going to completely change their IRP and upset 94% of their customer base to please the regulators that oversee 6%. So what are we going to do about it when we don't like them? Just saying we don't like it, I don't know, we've accomplished
we can't really answer that question until we start doing it and having those discussions.
Right. Like how drastic it is and to what extent we would like to take some sort of action. It's going to be really specific. If you remember the RTF discussion, That was kind of what we were discussing with XL Energy at the time. And so, I mean, there are some pretty drastic things possibly could be done, and there are some probably minor alterations as well, avoided costs, setting rates at avoided costs or so forth. And but again, we wouldn't really know until we would have a better picture, I think.
Well,
I think the key thing is figuring out some kind of idea what consulting costs would be on these so that... There's no sense setting a price. What number did you use in there? 175.
If a
low ball project is $500,000, then sure. We haven't accomplished anything with that bill.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, 175 seems like a good place to start, just because it's the same as a rate case, and so it would be hard maybe to suggest higher than that, but.
I mean, we're addressing ADPs as they come up one by one on a singular basis. But there was, I know I was frustrated with the last one because it's like, okay, we're making a decision based on a silo versus, a broader approach. I think it's definitely worth getting more information and taking a look at.
Sure. All right. So I think we got some direction on that. And I know I'm doing all the talking here, but Brian or directors, feel free to hop in if you don't feel like I'm properly couching a topic or any of these sections. These are just the notes that I kind of wrote down. But moving on to 49-2207 sub 3. And that will be under the Siting Act, the Electric Siting Act, page 2. That's just a cleanup section, and Pat and I had kind of marked that the subsections weren't properly cited, and I think that happened when they split out the Siting Act into to essentially pipeline refinement and electric generation. Is the next one, and that's on the waiver of procedures and time schedules. And over the years, you've kind of noticed that there were kind of skipped over one, but I'll come back to that one. But for the waiver of time procedures and schedules, it was contradictory with another section of law. If you see in there, it says that on page 11, after hearing, it keeps noting that after hearing. But if you look at a subsequent section, it says, for these waivers of time schedules and procedures, the commission shall not be required to hold a hearing. And so since those two sections were kind of in opposition to each other, we just thought since we're already in here cleaning up other things, we would just make that clear. The other thing that we just kind of cut out a little bit was the definition of emergency, and we kind of broadened it up just because if you look at emergencies used elsewhere in here as well, and we use that to hold a remote hearing. We're trying to make it more consistent, provide a little more flexibility in how you may address or what you find an emergency that requires some sort of change in procedures.
Okay. So the change under the waivers is to take out the requirement for a hearing.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to take one step further. If you go to 4922-13.
What page is that on?
Can you... I'll pull it out here in a second. Okay, it's on sub 3. I think it is, or... Nope, sub 2, sorry. Yep, it says, the commission shall hold the public hearing in any of these counties. See, maybe it isn't that. No, sorry, sub 2, sorry. The commission shall not be required to hold a public hearing on the application for a transfer site certificate or an application for waiver procedures and time schedules. So we shall not be required to do that. However, on this top section, it says, you know, after hearing. So
okay.
It was just to provide consistency.
Perfect. That is helpful because we've stumbled on that before. And where's the emergency thing? I thought that was a totally different place.
Actually, if you go to 19 as well, there are two separate sections in the Siting Act that I think...
page
29?
Sorry,
21. 21. That discuss emergency, and the other one was under sub 4, and that was for issuing a notice of publication through publication that we made.
Yeah. So that just allows us to do what Burgum has allowed us to do by executive order.
It essentially. I made these changes to allow us to do that on our own discretion if there is some sort of thing that arises where there's a public health or state emergency as you guys see fit. And it makes it abundantly clear that we'd be able to do that then.
In the meantime, is there any limit on that executive order? Any time ending period?
I don't think they set an ending date on that or time period, so it'll be when we withdraw it.
Do you have to?
Would it be contingent on his declaration of an emergency?
And this, as a...
No, not this.
Right.
What our current waiver... Is that
our current
contingent on his declaration of an emergency?
His executive order is based upon the emergency, yes.
Okay. So once he rescinds that, then we can't do remote hearings anymore.
I imagine he would have a basis for
it. Or he could revoke that specific executive order and leave the emergency for other things.
Either or, yes.
Do we need to define what a remote hearing is, or is it defined somewhere?
It's not defined. I don't feel that probably we need to really get too deep into how we're going to specifically hold our hearings. That would that only limits how we're going to have to do it. At least that's how I would try to address it.
The remote is in the sense that it doesn't have to be held in the county in which the facility is being. Remote just seems vague. Because in the executive order, it was more specific, wasn't it?
No.
It wasn't?
No, it just says we're not required to hold it in that location. It just revokes the locational standards. And there's a separate executive order, I think, that, well, maybe it does talk about allowing us to hold it remotely, but it doesn't specify how to hold it remotely. We did that through our notice, and we defined how we're going to hold our remote hearings.
As it should, because it's so technology-laden that's going to be something that's going to change in the next year. If we're continuing to do remote hearings a year from now, they'll probably be different than how we're doing them now.
No, I agree. I'm not disagreeing with that at all. I just think remote hearing, if it has the same backstop as the executive order did, then we're fine.
I would think of putting it remote, just putting remotely in there would provide you the discretion you need to notice it and hold it as you would deem fit.
But remote being defined is not in the same county.
Right.
That's clear here. Then
I lost track of my pages. Does this require an emergency to do that, though?
Yes, it would.
So as long as we're at doing this, should we also be fixing the situation, you know, as much as I'm hoping that we don't get so reliant on these remote hearings that then we don't go back to doing them in the areas close by when we are able to safely. But in those instances where we're talking about a county that doesn't have a quality handicap accessible, you know, all the things that a facility should have for important public hearings. Rather than having it remotely from Bismarck, it would seem to me we should be able to do the next county. And I thought the Burke County hearing was a classic example of it. I mean, where that wind farm was about as close to Tioga as it was to what town are we in? Bobells?
Mm. I think that's Bobells, yeah. Yes.
You know, it's just that there happens to be a county line in between there.
Mm-hmm.
We're not really talking about an emergency, but I sure wish as long as we're fixing this, we could figure out a way to have that kind of flexibility that without an emergency even, we could move a meeting to a more suitable place for the public than what a handful of counties in the state might have available.
Okay. I guess I didn't really, and I think Pat and Brian and I didn't have that in mind when we were looking at this, but we'll double check and we'll take into consideration if this is something we want to continue to do, maybe as an addition. There are a couple other items as well.
Yeah, it seems like if we're doing this, we should look at the possibility of that as
well. Is it possible that a county doesn't have an ADA-compliant facility in this day and age?
If you include bathrooms, for sure. We had a hard time finding a place in Bobells.
It just seems amazing that in the entire county there isn't one ADA-compliant facility. And that...
Well, maybe
this day
like for a big meeting?
Well, there's two things. A, do they have one? And B, will they let us use it? Some of them... You know, some of them don't want to have to clean up afterwards and stuff like that. And so we've been turned down before, too.
Our metal chairs ADA compliant.
In regarding this remote hearing, I know there are some concerns. Brian and I and Pat are all going to sit down and vet this pretty thoroughly once we know that's something you'd like to do and write it so it's clear and easily definable.
I think it's worth more work.
Sure.
I like looking at it. I think the language has to be
very
careful with the language because...
Sure.
What you've got going here is good, too, I think. Okay. Already, what you propose.
All right, so I'm going to step back on page 11. There's on the top of page 11, I forgot to write that down in my notes, but the half meg. So really what this section does is, as you guys are all aware, due to the variance in the siting act over the years for wind energy siting, it's kind of been bouncing up and down. It went up to, like, I think 100 megawatts, and it was at 50 for a while before it popped down to half a megawatt. So there are a number of wind facilities out there that are unsited. Not a lot of them, but I probably at least four that I could think of, and some are pretty large. Some are up to, like, 90 megawatts or so. What this essentially just says is, at the point where they do come back and they're going to repower the facility, at that point in time, we do want to take a look at it, and we want to cite it to make sure it's compliant with our laws.
Can we still grant a waiver on those?
Waiver of?
I thought that was one of the flexibilities we had when it came to, maybe I'm thinking of the decommissioning rules.
There is a waiver for a facility of small, five megawatts or less from certain requirements. Actually, for quite honestly, I think we in our administrative rules, we also have a small wind farm, 20 megawatts or less, abbreviated siting process as well set forth. So it's the intent was for it to not be that cumbersome for smaller wind facilities. However, it would ultimately require them to comply with, such they come forward and say they're going to comply with the laws of the state, and they're not going to have any, they're going to have minimal adverse impacts on the people in the area.
A half megawatt, and we're talking repowering, so it's already mm-hmm. on the ground.
Yes.
I mean, no one's going to put a...
I think the half megawatt is one issue, and then whether to do this is another issue. Mm-hmm. If there's a 1 megawatt single turbine wind farm out there somewhere, it's probably not a big idea, but some of these are probably 50 or 100 megawatts too.
Sure.
This has to do with whether at least this is my understanding, it's more of a question, but my understanding is that this has to do with, do we hold repowering of unsited wind farms to the same standard as repowering as of sited wind farms?
Yes.
And it seems to me, if you have a 75 megawatt unsited wind farm, we would want to hold them to the same repowering standards as a 75 megawatt sited wind farm.
Sure.
I agree with that, Randy, and how you phrased it. I circled the 1.5 megawatt just because I thought that's too far down.
Yeah.
Sure. That's just what it is for inciting.
Yeah.
But.
I mean, for requiring a certificate. It's just for repowering, like, do we want to make the monastery, I don't even know if they
no.
still have one, do we want to make them come in for a site certificate if they want to put up a 2 megawatt wind power instead of their 0.5 megawatt?
They wouldn't, because they're just, I think they're about 100 kilowatts for each of those towers.
No,
what if they put up 2 different ones?
Yeah.
What if they repowered those and made them
sure.
2 megawatts each?
Yeah.
No, not metering.
That'd be difficult for... But there are out there, for example, Turner Mountain, sorry, I mean, are you sure?
No, when you think of net metering on the solar side and, you know, rooftop solar, and what if, you know, a monastery wants to sell power back in and they have that?
Well, we don't allow net metering now.
Right, but down the road,
yeah,
who knows what will happen. I think 0.5 megawatt, I would agree, is too small if we move forward with this. And it's repowering the larger facilities, that's point in trying to
sure and that makes sense, because we do have a number of single tower facilities out there. The Lake Region City College, Turtle Mountain, I'm not sure if BSC has some sort of program out there where they have a tower. I know Basin Electric has a couple towers out there that kind of are sitting out there individually, and
it's the one east of that by Valley City,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So consider moving that up to a higher megawatt, like five megawatts. That would be over a single
tower.
Could
you just do it like, could you provide a carve-out for the truly single-tower ones?
We could, or we could just set it so that they can request a waiver for us.
Yeah, maybe that's
the monastery is too.
Two, yeah. Maybe requesting a waiver is the way to handle it.
I think the monastery is 200 kilowatts.
No, but they've got
two towers.
Got
a couple of,
right.
I think it's at least one. I'm not sure, though.
They might have two. I'm not sure either. So request a waiver for under 5 or something higher.
Something like that. I think under 5 is good.
Yeah. And but everyone's in agreement that they should, the larger facility should come in to get a certificate to repower.
I think they should.
All right. So moving on to 49-22-13-4, we kind of discussed that already. There was one additional change that Pat flagged for me this morning that I think might be worth discussing, and this would be more of a cleanup. Let's see, I think it's the second sentence, that notice of a public hearing and notice of opportunity for a public hearing on an application for a certificate of permit transfer or waiver shall be given at the expense of the applicant. We have that separate section of the law that says for any notice, they have to pay for it regardless. And so Pat kind of noted that maybe it'd be worthwhile just for the cleanup purposes, since we're already doing it, to just remove it so we don't have redundant provisions.
Tell me what would be removed.
The sentence, notice of a public hearing and notice of opportunity for a public hearing on an application for a certificate, a permit, a transfer, or a waiver shall be given at the expense of the applicant.
That's stated someplace else?
Under the powers for any sort of application, they were required to pay for the noticing requirements. We did that in the last legislative session.
In the citing chapter, we have a totally separate section for application fees. I think it's covered there, too.
Right. It seems to be covered in multiple places. I don't see that it's an issue having it remain in there, but Pat made the point that, how many times do you have to say it?
Right.
Totally get it.
No. I'm fine with it as long as it doesn't,
sure,
cause more trouble than it fixes.
Okay. We'll vet that through as well.
Yeah, just that we're double checking that it's, of course, that where it says it elsewhere applies to this.
All right, then 49-22-16.4. And that is the light mitigation technology. And there are a number of things to discuss with this. First off, Brian and I discussed this, and we were just kind of removing some of the dates to kind of provide some additional clarification.
Brian Johnson.
Yes, Brian Johnson, sorry. We didn't discuss this from this standpoint. Brian was also talking about working with Legislative Council to make sure that the date sunset as well. And I think it's a great idea. And I didn't think that these minor changes really would be controversial. However, I know there's been some discussion already between the three of you from Russo Wind and other wind facilities that if they're unable to get any sort of light mitigation technology implemented, that maybe they should be allowed to continue, or setting some sort of standards or an extension or so forth like that. I did want to just put that as a placeholder to tee it up to see if that is that's something that the commission would like to be proactive in engaging on.
I think that we need to talk about it, but I also think we need to first have the conversation with our rules.
Sure.
And see how because I think that's where we get into some goofiness.
Right.
Or gray area. And then I see that taking out of the June 5th, 2016 on number 2. Why would we be doing that?
It just says that everyone has to have a functioning life mitigation technology. However, it just says specifically in the next one, for the ones prior to June 5th, they have an additional time to do it through 2021.
Okay, so those two then don't contradict each other?
No.
Okay.
You move to the more specific one and then to the general one.
I think the rule discussion has merits, but outside of that, this is just really taking out some dates that have passed, mm-hmm, and no longer are applicable. These things have been met and we've moved on. And so as long as we have a bill covering this section of law, we might as well fix that.
Sure.
I think this is a true housekeeping move here. The rules discussion, whether there should be changes, is
And then that rules discussion we might find that we want more clarity in the law.
Right.
If, as we talk that in, I mean, whether it's driven by us or the industry, we just need to talk this through.
Right. So, but for now, I think we keep this placeholder since it sounds like we're going to have a bill on this section of law.
Sure.
We might as well fix this.
Right. And like I said, this is a minor housekeeping, and Brian and I will probably do another. We did a very quick review initially on this. We'll go through and we'll make sure that those dates were really not contradicting each other and
okay.
going to cause any sort of issue.
Is that consistent, the number one, the commission? So we're taking out, proposing to take out the by January 1, 2019, but it says shall adopt rules.
Mm-hmm. Which we did.
And we can do in the future.
And we can do in the future.
Most of the time when statutes like this are drafted, there's a way that legislative council can make them so that after the date passes, it changes itself without any sort of further action and then reads cleanly. Apparently that didn't happen here. And I've spoken with legislative council. It's just one of those oversight things where the sunset clause for the date itself wasn't placed into law, so now we're going to have to actually go back in and manually clean it up because that wasn't put in place.
The language stays in those instances, and it's just the date is removed?
Correct.
This is a pretty common housekeeping things when new bills are proposed. The legislative council usually looks at what's being done and also line out things like that and try to help them clean it up as well when they're missing and they don't do something like that. So I imagine they would do that regardless.
If we didn't propose this, mm-hmm. but proposed the rest of the things we're discussing, unless the lawyer down there just missed it, legislative council would do exactly this.
Yeah. No, I just think.
Correct.
I would think so, yes.
In legislative interpretation, if this is missed and when this has happened in the past, it's been set forth that it's like when the date's in there and it's an impossible date to meet because it's already passed, you read the law as if it's not in there. So whether it stays in or not, it's going to be treated like it wasn't in there. So, but it's just easier to clean it up when we're already in there messing around with other things.
I'm fine with that. I just think it's interesting that it almost sounds like we haven't adopted rules yet, or the commission shall enforce adopted rules relating to. It's just a tweak in language that. But if this is how it's typically done, then it's not an issue for me.
I don't see an issue. At the very least, what it shows is that we have the authority to do so.
Yeah.
The only thing that maybe we'd possibly do is step it back to be discretionary. But we've already done it, so there's really no issue for us.
I know. It just reads weird in terms of it's an after the fact.
Sure.
It's versus shall enforce adopted rules type of language. It doesn't have to be changed. Don't get me wrong. I'm just curious what past history has been on that.
Sure.
And it's good to know. Thanks.
Is there any sort of interest in taking maybe engaging and saying and adding something? There's such as, I know we have the extension for the older facilities, allowing an extension or exception for newer facilities if they can't. There's a technical or economic, or at least a technical feasibility issue.
Let's think about that.
Sure. So, would you just like me to mark and come back with and bring it up again later?
Because that's what we'll talk about with our rules too.
We will discuss it there as well.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
I think we can have that discussion then and kind of keep the law in mind as well.
Sure. Commissioner Krosis, one of the reasons that maybe leaving Section 1 to say shall adopt is we have to have them consistent with the FAA. So if those change, then it just allows us to adopt the changes much easier into the rules. So I guess as far as it reading funny, I think it maybe should read that way because of potential changes with FAA regulations and allows us to then adopt in our rules those changes as well.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's a very good point.
Okay.
We're moving on to 49-22-22, the citing process, expense recovery, deposit in the special fund, and continuing appropriation. Move to sub or 1D. This was something that Pat kind of brought up. In the event that is my understanding that someone requests an amendment to a site certificate or some things need to be changed and it goes to a hearing, we really wouldn't have any additional funding to process that hearing aside from the notice that's already set forth. And so what this would do is it really allows us the opportunity to request the cost that would to cover the expenses that we would need in processing the application and holding a hearing if there is some sort of disagreement. Is that correct?
Like we have the opportunity to ask for get an application before transfers.
Right.
And waivers.
Right. So it just kind of provides.
Just adds this one to the list.
Right.
Do we have examples of this?
Well, we generally with amendments, it doesn't come up very often, but.
I think Alderman was an example.
Alderman. Did we hold an informal on that, though? So we didn't actually go to a formal hearing, so it didn't require an ALJ and additional costs.
Right.
So.
And so we had to use that other
provision, system. Right. So it was covered.
But if we have an application for an amendment to the commission order, we don't have.
Okay. I guess I'm okay with that one.
Sure.
We wouldn't cover those costs.
Right. In the off chance that.
Yeah.
Right. Which could happen, though. For example, it may not just be us having a concern, it could be someone from the public having a concern. Right. And then if we had a hearing on it, we to be able to cover the costs, we'd probably be short.
I think it's a better. A more proactive approach to be prepared for it if that happens. And it's not like just a few years ago when once people filed these fees, we just kind of kept them. Remember, there used to be a lot of fees that just got built up here. They get returned anyway, and I think it, in that situation, as remote of the chances as there might be, if it happens, it will be nice to be able to have the resources to do our jobs well.
And we don't always know what's controversial. If it is, it might end up requiring a lot of resources. Yeah. Moving down to G, 1G, and this is a placeholder. I think I just tossed it in there, and Brian and I were discussing that we'd probably need to massage this a little bit more as well.
Okay.
That really, there's these instances, and I think Pat might be able to explain this a little better than I can, where the siting fees come in at, say, $10,000, but $10,000 may not be enough to cover the process, the cost of processing the fees.
Yeah. Well, I understand that, but why would you not just say, in the event that an application fee is less than $100,000, and then having that $100,000 at the very end? I mean, it's an extreme, but why would you mark it at 25?
Sure. I just put that placeholder number there, not because I really had a major thought that that's the right number. I just thought it might be more palatable of, say, for a gathering or transmission application. The funds that they put down, the capital expenditures for that, is very low. So you end up with a $10,000 siting or fee in that one, which, quite honestly, we're not looking to necessarily have a lot of additional costs, but between the recordings and the audio and the ALJ and the travel, sometimes that could get above $10,000. So we're just trying to cover that.
Let's
the processing cost.
Right. I'm just thinking, what if, and this is remote, and I'm not looking to run a tab up, but say, you know, we reduce the filing fee to $10,000, which we oftentimes do, and let's just say that extenuating circumstances, we're in a situation where it's going to cost $55,000, $60,000, $70,000 to process an application, and then we've capped it at 25.
Sure.
Then we just have to make up the difference, which isn't the end of the world, but
we'd have to make up the difference to go to the emergency commission and ask for approval.
Right. It's close to the end of the world.
I don't like
make up the difference in ourselves or yes.
I have some reservations on raising these, personally. I feel like. The industry is suspicious of it. They don't like forking over more money than they need or having the opportunity to do that. And for us to do that, so I'm open to some flexibility, but I really feel like the emergency commission option for us when we fall short is appropriate. And then we can go in front of them and say, here's why, and explain to them. And if it's a good reason, they'll give us the money. I personally just am hesitant to just give, kind of open up the window so that we can pretty much charge whatever we want whenever we want it, or have the companies think that we can. Not that we would or that we do, but there's already a lot of misunderstanding among legislators about how quickly we turn around that the fees and get them back, and how conservative we are with the funds and all of that. I think it's reviewed the opposite. So I don't want to add more fuel to that that impression personally. But.
Well, I think going to $100,000 would do that, mm-hmm. especially in some smaller cases, and it would give them, would give industry people a much better argument why this shouldn't be at all. You know, they can point out a real small project. And
mm-hmm. So you two want to get rid of F? That's what you're talking about.
Let me finish.
It already says up to $100,000.
That's under, that's already approved and that's in law. So I don't.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about that.
I'm talking.
The amount that up to $100,000 is set by there's. If you look at actually, I think sub A, B, C, and D, and it sets forth the amount that they shall pay to us, mm-hmm. and so. It isn't automatically up to $100,000. It's that amount that's set.
Mm-hmm.
So it quite, we do have them where they come in at $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000, and we don't have the opportunity to just automatically ask for up to $100,000. So,
I'm okay with taking it out. I mean, it's not something I would advocate for, but I just thought if it's going to be in there to begin with, make it consistent with.
Well, if I could actually be allowed to finish. I wasn't suggesting taking it out. I think going to 100,000 is too much,
mm-hmm.
but leaving it too low, I disagree that, the emergency commission is a fine option because we have time constraints on these, and the emergency commission might be quite a ways down the road. Plus, you know, when you go to the emergency commission, you're often branded as, well, you failed to get through on your budget. You needed more money than you were budgeted. I think emergency commission really needs to be real emergencies. And plus, they only had a few million dollars. Look at all the bigger emergencies in one of our siting cases from their perspective. So,
well, no,
I'm
don't
okay
they just
with,
approve us to go get more money from the company. They don't give us the money.
Right, but
they approve us asking the company for
okay, that's
money.
A good point. But yeah. It could take a while till there's the emergency commission meeting. I think raising it's, I don't know, I didn't find this unreasonable, but I would think going like to $100,000 sure might be too high.
And that's the reason why I set it at $25,000 as opposed to putting it higher, as I was just trying to make it seem very clear that we're not really looking to just, shoot the moon on this.
Didn't we just change this, though? I mean, I feel like we just recently went in and asked for more money as the base. Didn't we, Pat?
It was
we raised it to $25,000, right?
It was not less than $5,000 in the past, and then we raised it.
10.
So that would be up to 10.
And now we're saying we need it to 25, basically.
We're saying if in the event that $10,000 isn't enough to cover it, then we can ask up to 25,000.
Right, but just recently we went and said 5,000 sure. wasn't enough, so we need 10.
Sure.
And now we're going up to 25, so I just... I mean,
it probably made
do
a little.
We have the cases to say, like, we. I just wrote down what are examples that are driving this.
Right. And I think that I'm glad you brought that up because I was actually just going to say this is largely preemptive, Pat, right? Because not that we've gotten really tight, but we generally haven't run into a situation where we've been. We probably have gone over, but not.
When Jack and I had that conversation, I was saying there were situations where we would have gone over, but we cut back on certain things, travel. We cut back, and we got different bids on construction inspections. You know, we did everything we could to get the overall cost down. So
which I think the legislature would say is what they want us to do.
But well, I think, sorry.
Sorry, the other thing to keep in mind here is, like, a lot of times I think where this would apply is, yes, if there was a hearing and we had to go and pay for sound and mm-hmm. pay for rent and things like that, the travel associated with that. Does this philosophy change a little bit if we start holding more hearings, like, remote? Does that sure. save costs maybe somewhere where maybe we don't need this as much? Because, I mean, I know we have run into sure. instances in the past where it's been really tight, but...
It could, and we had this discussion, yeah. but the changes that we're proposing aren't to move all our hearings remote. What they're doing is to only an emergency, where we deem that there's some sort of emergency that we're going to move to remote. Otherwise, we're going to continue to hold the citing hearings as we can, but... I know Pat has been pressed in the past at certain times when he was discussing ways that, for example, that you could cut costs and not hiring it out for recording. Can we do that ourselves?
And sound system. Yeah.
And you, I know you've been pressed pretty hard, I think, a couple of times, right?
Yep.
Not even though we have been able to meet it in general, I know you have been had some concerns. And I think that's why we kind of put it up for discussion.
And in light of the fact that many of these are oil and gas industry things, and you know, maybe it's just a session too early for it. Maybe we just get through it as we have for another biennium. I don't feel strongly about it, but
is there any language we could add that would just allow us to have the conversation with the company about the situation and not necessarily demand that they pay us more, but request it? I mean, because I feel like we tried that with Alana on the Dakota Access one when we needed more money, mm-hmm. and it wasn't like we couldn't just ask them and get it from them. There was something that prevented that sort of just common sense approach from happening.
Well, there was an emergency commission clause, if I remember correct. That
did go to them, yeah.
Right, we did, but that's why we just couldn't. We were trying to get to the point, can we just ask for the extra money to finish processing without going to the emergency commission and kind of going through the whole rigmarole. And that I think the conclusion from legal and that standpoint is, no, we can't just get a signed agreement that this is okay. We actually have to go to the emergency commission to go beyond
yeah.
that.
So I guess what I'm thinking is, in these cases where it's just like, how can we just facilitate a conversation with the company saying, you know what, we're $2,000 short. Are you guys willing to provide another $2,000? And if they say no, then I don't know what we do. But it feels like most of the companies, if we share with them what we're facing, would be like, okay, yeah, or no, we want you to cut back on transportation or something else, but we've already tried all that and then we have like this issue.
I really think that is what we're trying to do here, and I think it is very easy to add some sort of a provision for the company to request
the commission
a hearing or an informal or something to discuss the amount that we're requesting. That would be easy enough to add language to, I think, and allow them an opportunity to be heard on it.
We could even just put it as the applicant permissive that they may upon the request. So, I mean, they wouldn't be beholden to it, but it would at least allow us to go there and say, listen, we're $2,000 short and we need to create a record here and we need to record it. And the company would say, yeah, that's fine. And it'll probably get us there faster if we don't have to sit there and pinch pennies to figure out how to get it done.
Yeah, the point I was making was from a consistency standpoint, the way I was looking at it, I think it can actually just be removed.
Sure.
And we can rely on the emergency commission at this point in time until we actually have a tangible example in hand of why we would want that flexibility without going to the emergency commission. And then it's not going to be perceived as raising rates again.
Keep him. I guess a real tangible example is going to be one that hits our budget.
Right.
Okay.
But then we have the emergency commission to go to. Correct?
Yep.
Well, I guess I'm getting a little bit of conflicting direction on this one. There, we could
maybe
say
just tweak it. Why don't you just talk about? You've heard what we're kind of wrestling with. Bring us another option and see if we can find some common ground.
Sure. Is that the entirety? All three of you want to see another version of it?
I'm open to it. I'm also open to it just going away because I think the backstop is in place.
Right. I am.
Sure.
I am too, but if there's some kind of really simple language that can be added to make afford a conversation, I'd at least like to see that, and we can always ditch it.
I'd like to see another option presented, because I don't think waiting on the emergency commission is... I'd like another backstop between that and where we're at with nothing.
I could see a situation where a company may not want to wait, too.
Right.
For the emergency. So, yeah, I think that we can definitely do that. Brian, I will work on putting something like that together for the commission. The last one is the 4922-25, and that's the protection of cultural historic site data. And maybe to provide you a little more context, as we get every once in a while open records requests, SHPL has a statute that allows, at the direction of the director, to protect certain information. However, a lot of times the cultural information that we're getting is not from SHPL, and so it gets a little confusing between third parties providing it based on SHPL data, what exactly and to what extent information can be protected. So a lot of times we get a request for emailing back and forth to SHPL saying, like, well, what can we redact? What can't we redact based upon your direction? And so this was to just provide there are these cultural, archaeological, and historical, paleontological sites that the state has an interest in protecting. The company probably has an interest in having that protected, because in order to get that data, they have to be able to ensure that it's protected, and we have an interest in actually being able to protect this as well for the public. So it just provides an...
I think it's a good thing. Yeah. I mean, we don't want to be the hole in the armor that causes something that is kind of a secretive place that they don't want to advertise and make something vulnerable to vandalism or theft. Mm-hmm. And then because of the law, we end up being the ones that release it. That's
true.
Jack, I have a 1 o'clock. Okay. And we're already at 12, and we have quite a bit left. What are you thinking?
You know, I really only think we have a couple left, because all the next changes to the pipeline, they're the same ones from the electric. So I don't know if we need really an additional discussion.
Okay.
They'll mirror them.
I'm fine with them.
Okay.
So the exception is the two, the wind repowering and the light mitigation requirement. So those aren't in this one, but otherwise they're the same.
Great. I guess there's only one other item I thought might be worth bringing up. If you remember when we had to reverse the flow on that pipeline, I was thought maybe a temporary and some section, or we draft a section saying that allows pipeline transmission temporary variances from this operation. I was just kind of curious to see if that would have a...
I'd like to see it. Okay. It's not in here yet. He's just thinking he'd do that.
Right.
I think I'd like to see it.
Sure.
I agree.
Okay. All right, moving on to 492306. PHMSA does the audits of the damage prevention program. One of the concerns they had is that we don't call the emergency services when PHMSA infrastructure is struck. And so as part of the audit concerns, we added in there that minor alteration. And I didn't think that would probably be something overly concerning, but
no,
that was good.
Okay, and then moving on to Title 51, the auctioneer's clerk license. There are a number of changes in here, but just to give it a quick overview, and of course, Conrad, feel free to, although I'm not stating it correctly, because it's been a couple days since we discussed it. That it really just kind of clarifies the license expirations and the late fees. And how that he feels that it should operate. And it also makes a notable change, actually, to the bonding section. One of the sections was deleted, and we actually just moved into two separate sections for clarification. But as it currently states, the bonding is set at $5,000 for auctioneers and $10,000 for auction clerks. And that now is set, as we have drafted it, as a minimum, and allows us to set standards and possibly increase it if upon a rulemaking process, I'm sure, to a higher bonding amount if we feel that that's necessary.
This was drafted in the same form. I don't like to bring this up around, but on the same fashion that we did with the grant program. The commission ultimately set the bonding and how the bonding was calculated. The concern that we've got is that the $5,000 in the event that it has to be called on would be substantially short.
How would you though? I mean, this really just opens up the door for us getting a lot more active in auction licensing.
In what?
And so, how would we do that? How would we know whether we should call for a higher bond? And I guess I would argue it also opens us up to more. We'd be more vulnerable for not having done anything to try to determine that a higher bond would be needed when it's our discretion to set the bond at the appropriate level.
And I think the plan would ultimately to review that and go through the rulemaking process and find what we feel is the appropriate bond to be set. And so I guess it was from the vision that we were going to be more proactive is my understanding of where Conrad was planning on going with it.
That is a bigger policy discussion that I don't think is one that we can have right now in this, you know, at this juncture. I mean, it's a significant change. So I guess I don't view that with in the same vein as all these other more housekeeping type changes.
Sure.
Or smaller policy matters. And would want to have a more thorough discussion of what's involved in that before I would even begin to entertain getting more active in this area.
So perhaps it compels us then at the next meeting to set up a work session to discuss what we want to do, how we want to move forward.
Yeah.
With action.
Yes.
And focus on that for a
works,
period of
yeah.
time. And then move forward with legislation if necessary.
I think so.
We do need to do it soon, though. Mm-hmm. So that if what we decide in the work session requires legislation, we have time to do it.
Well, and it also, I mean, quite honestly, it also has, it sort of runs counter to what we're being asked to do in the budget, you know, when we're cutting back.
Yeah.
True.
And we're having a 10% cut in our resources, mm-hmm. and looking at ways to do things more efficiently or doing less things. So this would be doing more things.
Sure.
With less resources. So I have concerns about that as well. But I haven't heard from, you know, I haven't had the discussion with Conrad to hear his vision. I'd like to see that and talk about it more thoroughly.
All right, so I'll flag this one and probably not do any additional drafting at the time being until we've had some further discussion on it, maybe at another work session.
Yeah, but in fact, I think I'm just going to throw this out. We won't do it now.
Commissioner Crispin, I think your mic is off.
We won't do it now since you have an appointment, but we can do scheduling outside of an open meeting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm probably not going to wait all the way till the 26th to first schedule a work session.
I don't think so.
So I'll work with Conrad on it, and he'll probably be in touch, and we'll get something set up, hopefully quite a bit sooner than that.
I like that idea, Randy.
Sounds good. I don't think there's anything we need to discuss additionally on top of that. I will save you guys the recap. I think I kind of did the recap as we were going along to make sure we understood it, and we'll try to get to work and start working with stakeholders, too, and just kind of floating some of these concepts. So you guys are comfortable with that?
So on the IRPs, I'm going to reach out to some of the state commissions, and we're going to
consulting amounts and find maybe how much we have to look
gather more information. And then
when do you think we should get together again? A month, or is that too long?
Might be too long.
I think we probably need at least
a month?
If you're comfortable with that. The drafting I don't think is going to take too long, but I think the reaching out and actually speaking with people and getting responses on consultants and particulars.
So then that would take us to middle of September?
Sure.
Maybe the week after Labor Day.
We're still on track time-wise?
Well, if we would be to meet it, but it is getting a little tight. So at that point in time, I think we should expect to start taking some more decisive action on these things then.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember correctly, the agency filing deadline for agency bills is sometime in mid-December.
That's
Mid to end of December. So as long as we have everything drafted and ready to go by then, and like Jack said, the drafting portion of it is usually fairly simple on most things.
Right. So I think probably we come back with some at least decent drafts and information in the next one, probably one subsequent meeting at least in between there with to make everything a little more concrete and before that deadline, and then we could probably take the rest of it from there.
Okay. So we can schedule a next follow-up at our next. And is there a rules? Are we sitting down to talk about rules at some point soon? Is that already on the calendar?
That's next week.
Okay, mm-hmm. Good.
Next Tuesday.
Awesome. Good. All right.
Is that rules just with licensing and compliance, or is that everybody?
It's whatever your heart desires, Pat.
It's everybody.
Okay. Well, whatever the commission desires, sir.
All right. Anything else?
Yeah, let's put together.
For the good of the order, because I know you need to get rolling.
Yep.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Appreciate
good job, you guys.
The work put into this. A lot of work.